Thank you for joining us today. To hear this program again, please visit our website at montevistacoc.com. If you're in the Phoenix area, come visit us at the Monte Vista Church of Christ. We're located at 2202 North 40th Street. We have Bible classes for all ages each Sunday morning at 9:30 and again on Wednesday night at 7. For more information about the Monte Vista Church of Christ or to request a personal Bible study, please go to montevistacoc.com.
Thanks for joining me on the Go and Teach radio program. My name is Ryan Goodwin. I preach for the Monte Vista Church of Christ here in Phoenix, Arizona. If you have any questions about the way that we do things at Monte Vista or any of the material that's presented on the Go and Teach program, then please reach out to our congregation. Any one of our members would love to sit down and have a Bible study with you. That's all we want, to open up our Bibles together and to share the Word of God and to come to a greater understanding of His will for each and every one of us, which in short is to obey the gospel and go to heaven. So if you have a Bible handy, go ahead and turn to Exodus chapter 20 in the Old Testament. That's going to be our main text for the day. So if you have a bookmarker, go ahead and put it there. We'll look at a few things here by way of introduction, though, before we get to Exodus chapter 20. Even though the Ten Commandments were given many thousands of years ago, they still continue to be in the news. Just recently, the state of Arkansas erected a monument of the Ten Commandments on the grounds of their state capitol. And in the very early morning hours of June 28th, a man named Michael Reed crashed his car into the monument, knocking it over and completely shattering it. Interestingly enough, the man 3 years earlier had already been arrested for destroying Oklahoma's monument of the Ten Commandments by its own state capitol. Now, this man's response happened to be the most extreme response, at least so far. But it does seem like every time we hear about the Ten Commandments in the news, it's being erected on a state capitol, or it's on a sign of some kind, or a plaque near the Supreme Court. And every time that something like this happens, it just enrages people of the world. The American Civil Liberties Union, for example, said on Tuesday that it planned to file a federal lawsuit challenging the monument, calling it an unconstitutional endorsement of religion. In addition, there are already plans in place for the Satanic Temple in Arkansas to complete its own statue on the Capitol grounds of Baphomet, a goat-headed, angel-winged creature that would be accompanied by statues of two small children smiling at it. I need to be careful not to be too sarcastic here, but I always wonder, what is the real conflict going on behind things like this? Surely any reasonable person, even a Satanist, has to acknowledge that the Ten Commandments stand alone in terms of their influence on Western civilization and the basis for its laws. There just is no competition between that and Baphomet or any other satanic, cultic practice that you can think of. I don't bring any of this up, by the way, to be political. I don't have any political motive when it comes to something like this. And whether a state chooses to put a monument to the Ten Commandments on its capital's grounds is irrelevant to me. It has nothing to do with my expression of Christianity. It has nothing to do with my understanding of the gospel either. So I only bring this up to prove the point that the Ten Commandments are still in the news, that they are a striking testament to God's knowledge, to God's glory, to God's moral code, and His expectations for mankind, that there is a right and a wrong. And in spite of what people in our culture might say about that, in spite of how much they might disagree with that idea, for the majority of human beings on planet Earth, it's actually quite comforting, and it comes quite naturally to acknowledge that there is such thing as a right and a wrong. So with our radio program today, I would simply like to look at the Ten Commandments and see what lessons we can learn from them. Now, I'm not going to do this in order to prove that the Ten Commandments apply to Christians today, or that we're accountable to the law of Moses given at Mount Sinai. In fact, I want to prove the very opposite, that we are not accountable to the Ten Commandments as far as the specific commandments themselves. But are there some concepts? Is there a heart behind the Ten Commandments? Lessons to be learned from the Ten Commandments that are universal and that transcend time or culture or covenant relationship. So there's a few scriptures I want to bring out that prove from the Bible that we're not under the law of Moses, and that includes the Ten Commandments. First of all, in Acts chapter 15, verse 10, the apostles acknowledge that the law was an unbearable yoke that neither we nor our fathers could bear, and that's coming from an experienced Jewish individual looking back at his own history, his people's history. In Romans chapter 3, the law reveals sin but has no solution for it. The law can't fix sin. In Romans chapter 6 and verse 14, it specifically says that Christians are not under the law. Romans chapter 7, verses 1 through 6. We have been delivered from the law. The law died, and we're free to pursue grace now. Romans chapter 8, verses 2 and 3, the law was weak. In the book of 2 Corinthians, it says in 2 Corinthians 3, verse 7, that the law is a ministry of death. In verse 9 of that same chapter, it's a ministry of condemnation. And in chapter 3, verse 11 of 2 Corinthians, the law is fading away. And no New Testament book explains the place of the law of Moses better than the book of Hebrews. In particular, Hebrews chapter 7, verses 18 and 19 says that the law is weak, that it's useless, that it makes nothing perfect. Going into chapter 8 of the book of Hebrews, chapter 8, verse 13 says that the law is obsolete, and something that is obsolete is growing old and ready to vanish. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 1, the law is only a shadow of good things to come and cannot make somebody perfect. And there are plenty of passages in the book of Ephesians. Go to Ephesians chapter 2, for example, in verse 14. Jesus himself is our peace, he says, who made both groups into one, that is, Jew and Gentile, and broke down the barrier of the dividing wall by abolishing in his flesh the enmity, which is the law of commandments contained in ordinances, that in himself he might make the two into one new man, thus establishing peace. That the law of commandments was the enmity. It was the separating wall between Jew and Gentile. And it is done away with. Verse 15 says, it is abolished in the flesh of Jesus Christ. So I believe Christians are sadly misguided today when they place so much emphasis on the Ten Commandments as if we're still under the Ten Commandments. But I can hear your argument coming. You might ask, so if we're not under the Ten Commandments, does that mean that it's okay to murder? That it's okay to commit adultery? That it's okay to covet your neighbor's possessions? That it's okay to lie or bear false witness? Well, of course that's not what I'm arguing. And the interesting thing about it is, even though the Ten Commandments and the whole law of Moses in general was done away with at the cross, there are many parallels in the New Covenant. Commandments spoken by Jesus himself or his apostles. Things that don't just mimic the Ten Commandments, but in fact are superior to the Ten Commandments. Things that go far beyond the Ten Commandments in their scope, their value, and their application. We don't want to be under the Ten Commandments. We want to be under Jesus Christ. Now, as I said in my introduction, with all of that being said, I still think there's value in studying the Ten Commandments, that they are informative. The Ten Commandments teach us about God and His nature, that there are things in the Ten Commandments, the morals of the Ten Commandments, the expectations of God, what He wants from mankind. The Ten Commandments themselves might not specifically apply because they're all part of the Old Covenant that was done away with at the cross. But they are nevertheless a window into the mind of God. They are, in a sense, the foundation upon which all other laws can be built. So let's set up the scene in Exodus chapter 19 and verse 16. So it came about on the third day, when it was morning, that there were thunder and lightning flashes, and a thick cloud upon the mountain, and a very loud trumpet sound, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. And Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. So once the people were consecrated, and they've been thoroughly impressed by the divine display of thunder and smoke and earthquakes, God begins to speak to the people. What the Lord spoke was the Decalogue, also called the Ten Commandments in other passages like Exodus 34, verse 28. It includes some of the most basic moral laws of the Jewish faith, covering their interaction with God and their interaction with other people. Each of these commandments can easily fit into the most important command of all, which is to love God, and the second command after that, to love your neighbor as yourself. While these laws have been done away with, like I said, we're no longer under them today, they do include some important moral concepts that can be found in the New Testament. So we start in Exodus chapter 20, and I want to notice verses 2 and 3 here. The first commandment is this: I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Out of the house of slavery, you shall have no other gods before me. There really shouldn't have to be a need for this commandment. It's self-evident that God completely deserves our utter obedience. And up to this point, God had been there for Israel through every trial and every trouble. He had assisted Abraham and his descendants. The Lord had found Moses and given him great authority. He'd brought terrible plagues upon the Egyptians, rescued his people from armies, and brought them through the Red Sea and the wilderness. For several thousand more years, the Lord would be there for them. He does deserve their love, as well as ours. The reason why we ought to have no other gods before him is simply because there are no other gods before him. Verse 4. You shall not make for yourself an idol, or any likeness of what is in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the water under the earth. Now this command might not seem so applicable to us today, but we need to consider the kind of idolatrous people that surrounded the Israelites throughout their history, especially their early history. In Canaan, for example, there were dozens of gods, most notably Baal, a fertility god who was also associated with omnipotence. Other gods were modeled after animals, but the absurdity of that is made obvious by Romans chapter 1, verses 22 through 25, in which the Apostle Paul describes the inherent flaw in idol-centered worship. You take images from the creation, and you worship them as if they were the Creator. Why would somebody want to worship a cow, or a wolf, or even the sun, when you have the more appealing option of worshiping the one who created all of those things? Another practical application that we can make is that God isn't interested in even people worshiping his own image. He says any likeness of what is in heaven above. We don't need to paint pictures of what we think God looks like, or what Jesus looks like, or Mary, the mother of Jesus, or an angelic being. He says in verse 5, you shall not worship them or serve them. Why? Well, because idols can't do anything. Idols can't help you. Why serve them when they're incapable of doing anything for you? Go to Isaiah chapter 46 and pick up in verse 5. To whom would you liken me and make me equal and compare me, that we should be alike? Those who lavish gold from the purse and weigh silver on the scale, hire a goldsmith and he makes it into a god. They bow down, indeed they worship it. They lift it upon the shoulder and carry it. They set it in its place and it stands there. It does not move from its place, though one may cry to it. It cannot answer. It cannot even deliver him from his distress. Idols need our help to move from one place to another. We bear their burden, not the other way around. In the case of the Lord, however, he carries our burdens. Now there's some explanation given here in verse 5 of Exodus 20. For I, the Lord, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and the fourth generations of those who hate me. Truly God is a jealous God, according to James 4, verse 5, but not in the way that we normally think of jealousy. He doesn't respond to our disbelief or disobedience with pouting or rudeness or pettiness, but with fairness and justice. As for the iniquity of the fathers upon the children, we need to consider this verse not all by itself, but within its context. God isn't teaching that children inherit the guilt of their parents' sins. Rather, like it says in Ezekiel chapter 18, each person is going to bear the responsibility for his or her own sins, not their father's sins or their mother's sins. So what God is most likely saying in Exodus 20 is that the consequence of parental sins are often felt by their offspring. Not that children bear the guilt of those sins, but that they sometimes have to face the consequence of those sins. And remember, this comes true with the very people listening to the Ten Commandments right now. Because that generation was disobedient to God multiple times in the wilderness, they were cursed to die in the wilderness over a 40-year period of wilderness wanderings. God said that that generation would not enter the promised land of Canaan, and it would be their children and grandchildren who would be the ones who would enter the land. So interestingly enough, this generation was disobedient to God, and their children were the ones who had to wait for 40 years to go to the promised land. Their children were the ones who had to feel the suffering of living in tents, away from home, wandering in the desert. Their children had to bear some of the punishment for their parents' sins. But let's move on to verse 7 now. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. Taking the name of the Lord in vain means any irreverent or empty uses of that name, according to the pulpit commentary. The Israelites are here commanded to guard their lips so that useless or profane speech never slips out. Profane speech about God or to God. We must always remember to keep the name of the Lord sacred and holy. It's not just any name that can be thrown around in a joke or an insult. It is the name of the Most High who deserves our respect. We don't deserve to speak that name at all, let alone abuse it. In a book called The Law of Moses by Daryl Emel, the writer says, we can misuse the Lord's name by using it to back up a lie. We also break this command when we use God's name flippantly or irreverently. A person's name is closely associated with the person who wears it. Names meant more to Jews than they do today. The Jews eventually came to believe that it was wrong to even use the name of the Lord at all. I certainly hope we can all see the application to today. That even though none of these commandments, at least in the form of the Ten Commandments, are bound upon us today, there certainly is enough parallel in the New Testament to say that we must keep the name of the Lord our God holy. We must never take it in vain. Moving on to verses 8 through 11, God then commands his people to keep the Sabbath, to keep it holy. Every seventh day of the week was to be special to them. It was to be used as a day of remembrance and a day of rest, in which the Lord himself ceased from the work of creation and rested. By the time Christ came to this world, though, the command to keep the Sabbath had been so perverted that its true meaning had been all but lost. A great story about this is found in Matthew chapter 12, verses 1 through 14. There, our Lord Jesus makes it very clear that this day of rest was never meant to be a point of contention for his people, but as a wonderful day of holiness and pleasantness. The purpose of the Sabbath day was to show the sons of Israel that God cared about their well-being. The Lord understands that there needs to be a day of rest for these people who had just emerged from cruel Egyptian bondage, from hundreds of years of slavery. For them, having a single day of the week to refrain from work would have been a welcome change from that slavery. Even though we're not commanded to keep the Sabbath today, in a New Testament sense, in a Christian sense, there is a Sabbath day waiting for all of us at the end of the labors of this life. Hebrews chapter 4 talks about there being a Sabbath rest remaining for the people of God. And in verse 11 it says, let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall through following the same example of disobedience. And I believe what he's talking about there is the rest that we find in heaven. Not a cessation from all activity, but an end of our earthly labors. God next says in verse 12 of Exodus 20, honor your father and mother, that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. The reasons for honoring our parents are numerous and practical. First, one must consider the fact that our parents raised us for all those years, sacrificing time and wealth and energy so that we can grow up. And for this reason alone, we ought to honor our parents. There's a great parallel, of course, in the New Testament in Ephesians chapter 6, verses 1 through 3, or in Colossians 3, verse 20. It becomes clear from these New Testament passages that there is no expiration date on the need, the command even, to honor our father and mother. My friends, by virtue of our birth, we owe them that kind of honor. We wouldn't even exist without our father and mother. Now, beginning in verse 13, God shifts gears a little bit here and discusses some violations of life and domain. He says in verse 13, "You shall not commit murder." And obviously, this verse isn't condemning all forms of killing, because God did command the Israelites to wipe out certain populations at times, and God did command them to practice capital punishment for certain crimes. Like Ecclesiastes 3, verse 3 says, there is a time to kill, and there's a time to heal. There's a time for war, as well as a time for peace. Verse 14 says, you shall not commit adultery. From the very beginning of time, Matthew 19, verse 4 says that God intended for marriage to be kept holy. Hebrews 13, verse 4 also speaks of the marriage bed being holy. God abhors adultery because it is, at its core, a broken promise, a broken covenant. There's no honor in breaking a vow, especially in a matter that is as holy and pure as marriage. Verse 15 says, you shall not steal. And what can be more self-explanatory than this? Stealing is taking from somebody else what you did not earn, something that is not yours, that you do not deserve. In verse 16, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And this verse is essentially saying that we should never accuse anybody of something that they did not do. This is echoed in Proverbs chapter 6, where it says, there are six things which the Lord hates, yes, seven which are an abomination: haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that run rapidly to evil, a false witness who utters lies, and one who spreads strife among brothers. Verse 17 says, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife. You shall not covet his servant or his ox or his donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. While it is certainly natural for us to want things and to see what our neighbor has and admire those things and perhaps even to have a desire or a motivation to one day earn those things for ourselves, there is clearly a line that we cannot cross. According to Biblical Ethics by McQuilkin, to covet is to seek something, someone, or some position, some recognition, or some pleasure that's not in the will of God. Notice that I use the word seek rather than desire. To covet is not merely wishing for more, but going after it, lusting for it, working to hold on to it. Or like Matthew 16, verse 26 says, for what will a man be profited if he gains the whole world but forfeits its soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? The desire itself isn't necessarily evil. It's the distortion of a God-given desire that's so terrible and so destructive. And this commandment is really teaching God's people to govern their passions, to be in control of their lust. Now, I want to reiterate, these commandments are not inclusive of every aspect of the law that was given to Moses and the Israelites. The Ten Commandments are, in a way, a summation of the most general attitudes and activities covered under the covenant given at Mount Sinai. We need to be careful not to overextend the point and purpose of these commandments or to apply them directly to Christians. They don't apply to us. The Ten Commandments are part of an Israelite law given to the Israelites. It was their covenant. It was the basis for their relationship to God. And the basis for our relationship to God now is the covenant found in Jesus Christ. But there are a lot of parallels, because God wrote the Ten Commandments, and God is also the one who wrote the gospel. His overall expectation for man has not changed, and that is that man must believe in God, and he must obey what God has said.
Thank you for joining us today. To hear this program again, please visit our website at montevistacoc.com. If you're in the Phoenix area, come visit us at the Monte Vista Church of Christ. We're located at 2202 North 40th Street. We have Bible classes for all ages each Sunday morning at 9:30 and again on Wednesday night at 7. For more information about the Monte Vista Church of Christ or to request a personal Bible study, please go to montevistacoc.com. Hallelujah.